The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
This is Greg Fries on behalf of Rob Terrio and Bill Toon for the EMS Educast. I just took a glance at the Medicast webpage. That's Jamie Davis's website and the ProMed Network blog, blog.promednetwork.com. And Jamie started to post the videos of the episodes we recorded two weeks ago at EMS World Expo. So if you've always wondered how beautiful I look, you can go and see me on video, as well as other EMS educators like Dave Koenig, Kip Tesort, Dr. Gustavo Flores, Kevin Colopy. Our videos from the episodes that we recorded are already posted there. And by the time you listen to this, they would have also posted into the actual audio feed that's available at emseducast.com. Bill, it's been a while since we've seen each other face-to-face, but I can attest for your handsomeness. Can you do the same for me?
Oh, stunning.
Well, thanks.
Absolutely stunning. There's no question about it. And look, you have a beautiful wife and kids, you know, so you're certainly, you know, have it all that's necessary.
Well, thanks. I was smart to marry a very pretty lady. And the transition to fall in Kansas has gone well for you.
Yeah, I think I might have a little head cold that usually comes with the change of the season. But so far, we're beginning to actually leave summer and catch a little bit of what it's like to be in the fall.
Well, that's the beauty of podcasting and using Skype, is that you can wipe your nose with your hands and cough and sneeze into your hands, and it will have no effect on me, even if your hand hygiene is terrible.
So true.
Well, I'm really pleased to bring in, for the segue from hand hygiene, to our good friend Chris Cevallero. What do you think of that segue, Chris?
I thought that was really good. You know, when it comes to hand hygiene and blowing your nose, being an Italian, there's nothing better, I would say.
You are the first person I think of when I sneeze into my arm.
That is very nice. I appreciate it. Because I have big arms or a big nose? Where are you going to go with that one?
Well, our friend Rob Terrio is not able to be with us for this episode, so I'm really glad that you jumped in. Listeners may have heard you before as the host of the EMS Leadership Podcast, or maybe they're saying, what, there's an EMS Leadership Podcast, and they just press pause, and they're going to find your podcast. Tell us a little bit about you and the EMS Leadership Podcast.
Well, it's great to join you, Greg, and we've done some shows earlier on, and we've kind of worked together before, and it's always great to be part of the Educast, and I still use the Educast when I train my instructors to go and research and come back, and that's one of the classes they have to teach is to use episodes of the Educast, so it's always great to be here with you. But my name is Chris Cevallero, for those who don't know me, and I do have the honor of being the host of the EMS Leadership Podcast, and for those of you out there that listen, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And, you know, the things we do, Greg, is we try to take some of the hot key topics that are going on in EMS, and sometimes we hear a story that goes on, and we kind of break that down so the EMS leaders can kind of say, you know, from their peers, you know, this is the way we would handle it, or we give some tips, or, you know, kind of the latest and greatest. The recent show we did, we kind of broke down what happened at EMS Expo. We kind of broke down what happened at Pinnacle. So one of the things we try to do is, you know, we don't really have that network of peers, or we need to have more of a network of peers. And we kind of bring that to you every week or every couple weeks. And, you know, it's really exciting. And I've kind of been the host now for almost 3 years, believe it or not. And, it never runs out of topics to talk about. And that's what's really fun about it.
Yeah, it seems the same here. If, this, we're doing a joint episode. This is a EMS Educast and an EMS Leadership Podcast. So, this will also be going out to your listeners. The Educast is the podcast by and for EMS educators. And, boy, I think we're coming up, I think we started either February of 08 or 09. We're in the high 180s for the number of episodes. And it's been an exciting run for Rob and Bill and I. And our co-host Buck Ferris and Chris Montero in the early days to talk to EMS educators around the world about best practices, things people are trying out, and just to really feature some of the great things happening in EMS education. If you're hearing about the podcast for the first time as a leadership listener, you can find us at emseducast.com and facebook.com/emseducast. Chris, did you throw in the URL for your show yet?
No, I sure didn't, but you could do that at emsleadership.com, and don't forget our Facebook page, again, at EMS Leadership, and, you know, come on by and check it out. You know, when you think about these podcasts, more and more people are starting to use them in different ways. I've heard people say they listen to us in their car on the way to work, or they're using us at the gym. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Greg, you got to me a few weekends ago. You were walking the dog and kind of sent me a kind of a great show. So I appreciate it. But, you know, people are starting to do this more and more. And with the Educast and with Leadership and with the Medicast, there's just so much great stuff out there for you to utilize. And go ahead and try that and do it. And we appreciate you listening.
Yeah, I might have to look up that text message you said sent, because there I'm in the dark walking the dog around the neighborhood, and you said something that made me laugh out loud, and I just felt really connected to you and the guests and the topic at that point, because it's so personal, and relationships and new learning comes from it. Gentlemen, I'm really pleased to welcome in to the podcast Jim Babylon. Jim, thanks for bearing with us as we talk about our different podcasts.
That's all good. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, it's really exciting to have you here. You came to me highly recommended by a previous Educast guest, Steve Whitehead, and I forget what we were originally looking to connect on, but we did that, and then I thought, well, this topic would be great for the Educast. But before we dig into the topic we're going to explore tonight with the vicarious trauma and secondary trauma, take a few minutes and tell us about who you are, what you do, really go back, how you got involved in fire and EMS, and sort of give us a good sense of what your career as well as your education has been like to get you to this point.
Sure. I started out actually in 1979. I was 15 years old, and I started volunteering for a local mountain rescue team here in Colorado. I ended up doing that for about 20 years. And that was kind of my introduction into EMS and being a responder. Very interesting stuff, being a mountain rescuer and being a volunteer. You work with a lot of different people, and it was just an excellent experience and a training opportunity for me. I kind of became enamored with being an educator in that organization, and still occasionally go back and do that a number of years later. I went from there into EMS and became an EMT in 82, I think. Lord have mercy. And I worked in a private ambulance here in Denver from 83 to 89. And did some 911 work, did pretty typical private ambulance work, I think, for most of us around the country. A lot of nursing home calls, a lot of transfers, a lot of running behind other responders. Very educational. Probably one of the best ways, in my opinion, to cut your teeth as a young EMT and a paramedic, which is what I was. I went from there to the Parker Fire Department in 1989 and was a paramedic. And eventually I retired here just in 2011 as a truck officer and paramedic, and did a variety of other things that I had had unique opportunities to participate in. I was with the FEMA task force on the incident support team there, where we would go up ahead of the task forces and do things like 9/11 and Oklahoma City and Katrina, and just amazing experiences being a part of history, really. And between that and my time at Denver General, I went back and didn't have my street fill, so I went back and got that. worked at Denver General in the paramedic division while I was working at the fire department. So I did a whole lot of paramedic in there for a while, about 6 years. I'm pretty sure I didn't sleep, or at least not much. I managed while I was at the fire department to participate in the USAR program, did wildfire as an operator and in the management team process. I was a SWAT medic. I became involved in counterterrorism with Department of Defense in the domestic preparedness program. Some of you may have seen or participated in those trainings several years ago. We went all over the country and instructed responders in how to deal with nuclear, biological, and chemical events. That was kind of my backdoor way getting into hazmat, which I still end up doing a little bit of for my fire department, even though I'm retired. I've had a lot of really neat opportunities, and I've had the chance to work with some outstanding clinicians at all levels, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, doctors. And I like to think that I'm still a student and I'm just trying to get it all sorted out. And I've been doing this a long time, and it's been very good to me. So that's kind of where I'm at in a nutshell, where I'm coming from.
Yeah, that's quite a background, a lot of different experiences, and just from the urban setting out into the wilderness, and from the plains to the mountaintops, and sort of everything in between.
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky. I have not passed up any of those opportunities that were presented to me, and that's always my recommendation when I'm asked often by younger folks who are just starting out, you know, what should I do, and how do I get involved, and how do I be like you, and that's my biggest advice is when those opportunities come up, don't pass them up. Never pass up a chance to participate or learn something, and you'll do all right.
Yeah, that's along the way, did you fit in some college or any of that post-secondary?
You know, I did a little bit. I got my associate's in fire science, and I'm currently working on my bachelor's actually in Middle Eastern studies.
Okay.
I spend a little bit of time in the Middle East and dealing with terrorism education and suicide bombing and that kind of thing. And I've been very fortunate to cultivate some friendships and relationships in Israel with those folks that unfortunately are really, really good at understanding and responding to terrorism. So that's what my four-year degree will look like someday. I have no idea when that will be, but that's in process.
Well, one of our reoccurring themes on this show is really the importance of that. Obtaining a college degree, and it's never too late. Even if you've had many years in the field, and you know, that's the Bill and I always pushing any young listeners that are just a few years out as paramedic and then starting to think about educators, make sure you get back in school and finish that degree. So what kind of coursework are you doing for a Middle East studies degree? That's intriguing.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is the history of the area, different religions, and the study of Judaism and Islam. And actually, you have to do Arabic 1 and 2 to complete that degree. And I speak a very little bit of Hebrew. I should say I understand a little bit of Hebrew would be more accurate. And Arabic's an incredibly difficult language to master, so that's coming up here, and I gotta tell you, I'm not looking forward to it. It's gonna be a challenge, and some people just have that, whatever part of your brain is wired to learn languages and to be real good at those, and I'm really still working on English, so I don't know how that's gonna work out.
So is that a degree you're doing locally, or is it
It's actually from American Military University. Okay. It's an online degree, yes,
okay.
Sir.
Excellent. Well, Bill or Chris, jump in with questions about Jim's background.
Well, I think that one of the things that I find interesting, you know, is as we get to talk about, you know, the topic we're going to discuss, it seems that you have a lot of experience when it comes to dealing with the catastrophes. You know, you talked about Oklahoma City, you talked about Katrina, you talked about 9/11. If you were to think about the biggest lessons that you learned at that that came from that to develop your, maybe your passion or your, you know, where you've come, how far you've come. What do you tell us? What do you share with us from that?
Oh, wow.
Was that a top? You want me to come?
Yeah.
What size shoe do you wear?
Yeah, about, right, right. That one was, that was right over the plate. That's a good one. A lot of things come to mind. I guess, the first thing that comes to mind is that we, traditionally, it's changing, but traditionally we have not done a good job in EMS, fire, law enforcement, you name it, of taking care of each other with regard to our, mental and emotional and even physical health. And that those events, those catastrophic events can have catastrophic impact, on our people and our comrades. And I know, at least two people that I knew personally that are not with us anymore, that took their own lives, and they were both 9/11 responders. Was that the reason? I don't think so. I don't think it helped. And I know that, that there are a lot of other people that really are out there and they're hurting. And I don't think we've done enough. And that's why I, speak on this subject and why I'm an advocate for, people understanding, vicarious trauma and secondary trauma. And as you probably have already guessed, I'm a survivor of, post-traumatic stress and secondary trauma myself. And that, that experience, really has changed me. It probably shortened my career. It had psychological and emotional and physical impacts. And, I think that's the biggest lesson that I have taken personally from those, events. And they don't have to be super catastrophic, but whatever the impact is, that, that we need to do a better job at taking care of each other than we've done up till now. That's for sure.
Well, it certainly is interesting. And you know, a lot of the great mentors and role models that we have in different specialties, unfortunately, gain that experience from actually, you know, living through it. So, Bill, I'll go ahead and throw it to you, or Greg, what question you lead them to next?
Well, I think that it's I think we're ready to jump into it. I'd like to hear a little bit more about what do you think EMS educators can do to be better at preparing future practitioners to, let's say, be resilient.
Sure.
And before we get to that, I just want to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. The time is right to do that.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones or other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. One Indiana EMS service manager called scheduling a part-time job all by itself, but with EMS Manager, he was able to schedule an entire month of coverage in just a few hours. That's a significant amount of time and money saving for services struggling to make ends meet. It's affordable, too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there is no additional local IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. We would like to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast and other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for the free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LADtech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workplace management. Let them know you heard it here on the EMS Educast. emsmanager.net.
Jim, I think Bill's question is a great one, and I want to make sure we get to that. But maybe before we do, Bill, would it be all right? I just am looking for a definition, maybe some examples of vicarious trauma and secondary trauma before the what educators can do to help grow or nurture or encourage more resiliency.
Absolutely.
Let me get that up because I want to get it right. And there are many places you can go to see this. And like many things, there will be differences, subtle differences in the definitions. But vicarious trauma is defined as the transformation in the helper's inner sense of identity and their existence. And it results from utilizing controlled empathy when listening to our clients' trauma narratives or when we are a participant in their trauma. In other words, vicarious trauma is what happens to your neurological and physical, psychological, emotional, even spiritual health when you deal with those traumas day after day after day. And eventually, for a lot of people, certainly for me, a transformation occurs and you end up going from a reasonable, rational, empathetic care provider to someone who is not any of those things. And if you're not careful, that exposure to those traumas repeatedly will take the ultimate toll, and you will either suffer from somatic, you've somatized that, your physical body now manifests that trauma to the point where you have heart disease and stroke and so forth, or you end up trying to band-aid that over with drugs and alcohol. I can assure you that doesn't work. Or unfortunately, those individuals that just don't have anywhere anywhere else to go and nothing else to do, and they take their own lives.
You know, it sounds like a horrible process that people have to go through to, get over this. It's really great that there are folks out there like you that can share that experience with them and to, help them in those situations. You know, Greg, as EMS chief, do we really have the knowledge and the skills? Do we really think about this as really being something that we have to do, whether it's with our students to teach them, whether it's with our employees when they're out in the field and they see these things? And it just makes you realize as you hear this, are we really prepared to deal with it ourselves,
That's why I think it's at least from an educator's point of view, I think the value is it's something that needs to, I think, be integrated throughout the program. And when I was a primary paramedic educator, one of the early things I did very early into my programs is I brought the EAP folks in, the employee assistant folks in, because I was a hospital-based program, so we had access to the employee assistant program. And I was fortunate enough to have a very talented practitioner there who came in and talked about it right from the beginning, but continued to revisit throughout the entire year. Referrals were made to them, from anyone on my staff, and really trying to prepare people that it's okay and there is help out there to get, and it's important to get. And, that I was doing well over 20 years ago when I was running a paramedic education program. I think it's very valuable. I'm a 100% supporter, and we need to help people realize they need to get help.
Right, I agree. Jim, hop back in. Bill's given us that idea of the EAP is one step towards resiliency. What are some other things?
I think there's a few things. We've already hit on the most important one, which is awareness, that we all just understand that the problem exists and that it's okay for our comrades, our employees, our people, the people we're responsible for and the people we're next to. It's okay to be affected by these things. It's expected. You should be affected. That's a human response. When I first started in rescue and EMS, that was really not the case. It was all about being in control and not showing any vulnerability, and everybody understood that you could be affected, but it wasn't okay to show that you were affected. And I think we've crossed that hump in most places that I have been around, that it is now at least understood that it exists and that it's okay to be hurt and it's okay to get help. And I think the way that we do that is critical. And there's a lot of information out there right now, and there are more studies going on all the time, that some of the steps we've taken in the past, like critical incident stress debriefing, may not be the best way to go for everybody. It turns out that in looking at those studies, that only works. The CISD model works for about 40% of us, give or take. And the rest of us, it doesn't do anything for. As a matter of fact, depending on your part of the call or where you were or what you did, you may be subjected to a trauma that you didn't know anything about. And are actually being traumatized if it's not done correctly. And please understand me. The people that volunteer and have done CISD and that tried to help me, I don't know how many hundreds of times. God love them all. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing that. It just turns out that model, it doesn't work for all of us. And if not done correctly, it can actually hurt people.
So we've talked about the EAP and just the really importance of awareness that you should be affected by terrible things that you experience or see or hear about. What are some of the other things that are working or at least maybe have some promise for being helpful for people that have either something sort of acute happen or sort of this like build up over time?
Sure.
To work through that or manage it.
Well, the most important thing we can all do, aside from what we've already done, is recognition, is prevention, for lack of a better term. And what I mean by prevention is that you try and keep your life in balance, your work life, your personal life. And I know that for me, most of my life in emergency services, that's what it was about. I was a responder. That's what I was about. That's what I did. It's all I – there was a time in my life where I was a mountain rescuer and a paramedic at Denver General on the streets and a fire paramedic. And I worked 100 hours a week, and I'm not singling myself out. I know there are many people in our business that do the same kind of thing. They burn the candle at both ends and in the middle, and then you have someone that's just set up to be traumatized because you are not in balance in your life. And having that balance is absolutely critical to having some resilience when it comes to being traumatized by this stuff. So I think that's absolutely huge and something that gets neglected a lot in our line of work.
Yeah, I heard somebody say not too long ago, talking about, you know, if you can be managing sort of the small day-to-day stresses of life and keep those things in balance, that you're just going to be better prepared if there is some major stress event that happens to you, because it won't be added on to all sorts of other undealt with stuff. They probably had better terminology than I just used, but that's what I took away from it. It was just this idea of balance.
Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that it's really big. It's really important. And that most of the people that I know in our business are not the definition of balance. God knows I was not until I understood the importance of it. And by then I had already suffered a lot.
I agree with you 100% there. I think that I certainly, in the early, for easily the first half, if not more, of my career, I had no balance whatsoever. And I've gained it with the latter half, or maybe less than the latter half, a third, to realize the need of balance. But something I know Greg is an avid runner, And I really think that the other thing that we're which is very helpful to people is we need to teach them not only the importance of their family, but the importance of their body, their physical health along with their mental health, what they eat, how they exercise. You know, I continue to be embarrassed at times when I look at practitioners that show up on TV or in pictures or actually see them, and they do not even look the role of a healthcare provider and stuff. And you sometimes wonder how they can even do the job, whether it be the way they smoke or their drink or their lack of exercise or just how they carry themselves. So I think it's important, again, that we don't forget the physical aspect of what needs to be done to help people with their balance.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Bill. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Jim, and as you talked about that, depending on where you are in the call, you may not even realize you've been in a trauma. It made me think about when you think about vicarious trauma, when you think about post-traumatic stress, and you know, thinking about the guys that are coming back from the war and the things that we see in our job. Are there different levels? Do you have a sense? Are there different levels of post-traumatic stress that you may not even know you have it until someone points it out to you?
Absolutely. I know that I was a poster boy for post-traumatic stress, and I honest to God, didn't know until I was sitting in a CE session, and God bless whoever it was doing it. I don't remember. I should, but I don't. And they were going through a list of here's the kind of things that you experience when you have post-traumatic stress, when you have trauma that you haven't dealt with, and you're affected, and you are exhibiting these things. And she's going down this list, and it is literally signs and symptoms of my life. And I'm going to do the same thing for you right now.
Yeah.
Sleep disturbance, like that ever happens in our business.
Right.
Use of alcohol or drugs. Use of sick time that gets excessive. Flashing back, and that doesn't have to be a huge, dramatic, cinematic movie experience. If you have intrusive thoughts, that meets the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual for mental disorders. That meets that definition. Physical consequences: eating too much, not eating enough, headaches, cardiovascular, neuropsychiatric, whether it is nightmares, other somatization that you have, like for me it was my memory. My memory, which had always been like a steel trap, I was an excellent student, it just became impaired. And that was a big part of it. And then what I didn't understand about any of this until I got into it myself, obviously as a patient, a consumer, was that there are physical consequences to these traumatizations. And for me, that was a big part of it, is it screwed my brain chemistry. And that's when you have stuff like not sleeping for 6 years and nightmares and flashbacks and difficulty with relationships. You know, all the people around you are the ones that notice most of this stuff before we do. And they're also the ones that pay the lion's share of the butcher's bill. Which is unfortunate, but it's true. Routine simple calls become real difficult to deal with. You're very, and we all have either had this happen or we work with people that have, where they're just on the ragged edge. They are stressed out, and it takes absolutely nothing to push them over the top. And one of the things that I did discover is that in most men, depression manifests itself as anger. And not necessarily as the boilerplate template, you know, expectation or definition of depression. And it certainly was for me. Shorter temper, lack of motivation, people that are isolating themselves from their friends and their family and anything else in life, but just being at work and being pissed off. The chances are really, really, really good that you have been traumatized and you need help. And this is not something you can, you know, work for me anyway. It wasn't something I could work my way out of. I had to have help, and I had to have a lot of help.
How, you know, Jim, and, you know, stop me if this gets too personal. Like, how hard was it for you to, like, hear that list of symptoms and then sort of come clean with those around you and say, you know, yeah, this is me and I need help? I mean, I'm just looking at your resume again and what you listed off. I mean, you're urban paramedic, on the USAR team, SWAT medic, mountain rescue. Like, you're the guy, right? You're the man, like, doing all this stuff, like, out in front. The more difficult the assignment, the more likely it is you're going to be there. Like, how tough and how did you do that? Like, how did you go and say to your peers and even the people that looked up to you, like, all right, this is not working. I have a problem. I need help.
Yeah, I got to tell you, at first I didn't. I was in a pretty severe state of denial. And eventually it took a good friend of mine who was a partner at work to sit me down and have a come to Jesus, no disrespect of any kind intended, and say, you know, dude, you are messed up, man. When's the last time you slept? And I stopped and thought, and I couldn't answer his question because I didn't know the answer. And that was one of the first things they did for me, actually, is when I finally got in to see a counselor or a therapist, was to get some sleep medication and get a few nights sleep. And that makes a pretty big difference in a guy's life when you haven't slept for 6 years to lay your head down for a few hours, I got to tell you. So that helped a lot. Once I started that process, it wasn't a nice, okay, now I'm messed up, I'm going to see somebody and get fixed. It took years of on and off and being in denial and not being on medicine and then not wanting to be on medicine. And I went through that all myself, and my wife will come down here and tell you today, still, I have those times that I go through that. But thanks to, you know, my loved ones, my family and friends, and my faith, I'd be completely remiss if I didn't mention that. And I'm not pushing it on anyone else, and maybe it's not for you, and that's fine. But for me, it was the difference. And that all made, you know, eventually it all came together to the point where I was able to get back in the saddle and didn't exactly finish my career up like I wanted. I had some other cardiovascular stuff that went down, and I just couldn't stay online anymore. So now I'm a teacher and a consultant, and I'd much rather still be in there doing it and swinging an axe and kicking down doors and doing bad guys, but that's not the way it worked out.
Well, we're glad to have you as an educator, so you're certainly welcome here. And I'm curious, all three of you maybe could answer this. You know, you referred to as the Come to Jesus meeting. You know, when we recognize these signs and symptoms, whether it be a peer or a student or somebody that we supervise, like in your case, Chris, like, I don't want to use the word intervention, but I can't think of something better. Like, how do you have the conversation, whether it be with a peer or a student or an employee, of like, hey, this is what I see, it's going on. Like, how does that go down?
Well, I think one of the best things that, and regardless of those scenarios that you gave us, I think the important key is that you have to know the people. You have to know the people that you work with. You have to know the people that you're teaching. You have to know the people that are involved in those, you know, in those environments with you. If you know that, then you can tell, you know, where the normal is breaking from. You know, I made the comment today to somebody that the best way to figure out what's wrong with your car is to let somebody else drive it and let them come back and tell you what's going on, you know, because you just get used to it. So the people that are around you, when I have my folks, I can tell when they're having a bad day. You know, when you think about emotional intelligence deals with not only your own emotions, but the emotions of the people who are around you. So anytime there's one of those calls that could cause people to have negative feelings, you just want to check on them, and you just want to be able to know that they're who they're supposed to be. Well, to go back to your question, Greg, if you've got to sit down with them to say, you know, that something's going on, I usually try to take the conversation just into a normal conversation. And I'll tell people who come past my office, come on in and take a seat and let's talk about something that you want to talk about. And then we just have that normal conversation. And then I'll kind of swing the conversation back to, you know, the trauma or what's happened or the call, and just see if I can get them to talk about it. And then basically, I'm no psychologist. I'm not any good at, you know, delving into dreams or anything like that. But I do know that the resources that we have available and to get them to, you know, to those areas. So, but I think the key to it is you've got to know your people.
Yeah, and I would agree with what Chris has to say there 100%. And I think that is and each of them are a little different, whether you're dealing with students or whether you're dealing with employees. But I also feel as if you're sitting next to someone in an ambulance that you have a responsibility, or in a firehouse, you have also a responsibility and an opportunity to get to know them, that you should be able to have that frank conversation with them that says, hey, what's going on? And just continue that conversation on from there. You know, it's always a little different when you're the program director and or you're the supervisor or chief of something. You know, sometimes the other thing is not only do we want to take care of our paramedic, but if we take care of them well, then they'll take care of patients well. If we're not taking care of them well, we put the patients at risk, and I think that then we have an obligation. So we can never forget, I think, that all of us have an obligation, and the obligation is not to punish. The obligation is to get them healthy and help them get to that place. That's what's important.
Your thoughts, Jim?
I couldn't agree anymore. I think it's critical for all of us to, and we have an obligation to recognize those people, be they peers or other agencies or people we're responsible for that might be in trouble, and to make sure that they get whatever assistance they need. And that brings me right where I was going, which is, you know, what does that look like, and what assistance is there, and what and where should we be going with this stuff? And we talked about critical incident stress and how that doesn't necessarily work for everybody. There's another what am I going to call it? Mode, I guess you would say, of treatment or operation. It's called psychological first aid, and you should query that and take a peek at it. And then, interestingly enough, it's the Israelis who actually have been doing this for the longest. They actually send with the responders to a major incident, which they've had a lot of practice. They send behavioral health professionals to respond, and not just for the responders, but for the citizens. And everybody in Israel is a responder anyway. It's just the nature of the country. But for everybody who's affected by those, some of those are horrific events, and that they start that psychological first aid concurrently with physical aid. It's very impressive and robust, and they've had a great deal of success with that. And they know quite a bit about psychological trauma, and it's something I think we need to take a hard look at. There's no question that we've made leaps and bounds, I think, and EAPs are good, but not all EAP counselors are trauma trained or trauma professionals, and I think that's what our people need, and that's what they deserve. And that we should have those kind of folks available for our people to decompress and to start their process. If you can start taking care of them right away, the severity and duration of their traumatization, for lack of a better phrase, is going to be significantly less than if they're left to their own devices. If you look at the DSM, and I am not a counselor, a psychiatrist, psychologist, so this is not medical advice, this is just my own hard-learned experience. But if you look at the DSM, the difference between an acute stress reaction and post-traumatic stress is 30 days. And I was shocked by that, because that's really not, it's really not very long. And part of the deal with that is that those traumatic memories imprint into your memory. After 30 days, you got it. And to get rid of it takes a significant amount of work, and depending on your therapist and whatever other modes of treatment, you can be looking at cognitive behavioral therapy or EMDR or psychotherapy or medication or a combination of all those things. When, you know, if we do this right and we apply that psychological first aid template, then that we can be saving people so much pain and trouble and a disjointed future. It's just, it's better for everybody. You know, if the employees are happier, they're doing a better job, they're going to last longer, we take care of each other more. It's, to me, it's a no-brainer.
You know, this, if you could just mute your end of the line there. The idea that psychological first aid is certainly intriguing, and you know, I often hear about, you know, there's going to be counselors standing by, you know, maybe something has happened at a school and then the kids are returning to the school and they say, you know, counselors are going to be available for the kids. And it seems to be a sort of a surge in the first few hours, and you know, psychological first aid maybe moves the start of the surge up earlier, but then I feel like it quickly tails off. And I just want to share a brief personal experience that, you know, longtime listeners probably recall that I ran the Boston Marathon in April, and was a few blocks away when the bombs went off, and the, you know, but many, many people were impacted by that event. Mentally, you know, relatively speaking, a small number, you know, were physically injured, but many people mentally affected. And then me, like a lot of people that day, that same day or the next day, got on a plane and flew to far corners of the world. And I recall in the days afterwards, there was emails from the Boston Athletic Association saying, you know, counseling is available, or here's some resources. But then, just last night, they had a webinar. They invited runners to participate in this webinar, and talked about how, you know, this was a traumatic event for lots and lots of people, and it's natural to have this on your mind, but it's not good for you to let it affect your sleep or your eating or your relationships or your general health, and here's some things you need to be start doing with it. And I was sort of really stunned based on the questions they were sharing in this pre-survey of just sort of like how deeply impacted some people were compared to me. And still, I guess what, 6 months later, it was sort of a, you know, like you said a few minutes ago, it's not just the responders, but it could be the bystanders as well, they're affected by events like the Boston Marathon bombing.
Absolutely, and I think that's a reflection of those kind of events, that we don't have any corner on the being traumatized market. Anybody who's exposed to that stuff, you know, can easily be affected, and that's something at least. In my practice as a paramedic and as an EMT, I never took the time to learn until, you know, obviously much later in my career, or to really engage in trying to take care of people at all, emotionally, psychologically. I grew up in a paramedic system where, you know, if you were really sick or really hurt, you're in a really good place. We're going to take fantastic care of you. But if you were not really sick or really hurt, yeah, not so much.
Well, I don't know if you guys have any experience with that in Denver, but a lot of places. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's all good. It's just, that you really brought that out when you said that. It really, It's something that convicts me a lot. And one of the pieces of advice I have for young paramedics, you know, you got to take care of the whole person. And that's not something I did very well myself or that I was very good at. And I think it's something, which I know is really off topic, but it really strikes me. And I think it's something we need to do a better job of.
Yeah, we're nearing the end of our time together. I think we've got the chance to go around the call one last time and get either another question or comment from Chris and Bill for Jim, and then a final comment from you, Jim, and then we'll start to wrap up the show. So, Chris, do you have a final comment or question for Jim?
Yeah, I'd like to just ask, you know, Jim, we've covered a lot of things, and I've got a page full of notes here, and it seems like we've only scratched the surface as to how serious this can be for folks. But now that you've identified, you know, kind of the symptoms that people had, and if there's people that are coming to the aha moment to say, oh, my goodness, this is me, what's the step for them? Where do they go from here?
You know, that's the most important part of the evening, and unfortunately, there's no one single answer. It depends completely upon where you work and what your resources are. No matter what you do, you gotta sit down with somebody who can get you some help. Now, that might be your supervisor, it might be a friend, it might be a nurse in the emergency department, maybe it's somebody who works in behavioral health or mental health. You've got to take that first step. You've got to find somebody that can get you into the system, or you can work with someone who understands trauma. And I got to tell you, it can't be just somebody who's a counselor or a therapist or even a psychiatrist. They have to have a background in training in dealing with people that have experienced trauma. It is hugely important that you do that. You can be okay, and this will all be dealt with. And I know right now it doesn't feel like it, and it doesn't seem like it, but you will be better, I promise. But you gotta take that step, and you gotta find somebody who can help you take those steps into finding someone who's an experienced trauma behavioral provider.
You know, one of the themes in the webinar last night was that it does get better. And, you know, to start yourself on the process of getting better, simply acknowledging that you've been affected, you know, and from there, there's all sorts of different things you can do to help you get better. But simply acknowledging that you've experienced trauma and it's affecting you helps you get better was one of the big themes in the presentation I mentioned earlier.
I think that's absolutely correct, and I would leave you with this one too. Colonel Dave Grossman, who's an excellent author and an expert in violence, and if you want to read a couple of good books and a little better understanding of mass shootings and all that kind of stuff on killing and on combat, Colonel Dave Grossman. But he describes PTSD as a pack. And it's a pack that you're wearing. And when you start out trying to get some help, that pack is awfully heavy. But every time you get a little help and you deal with one of those traumas, one of those issues, you take a rock out of the pack. And pretty soon, instead of walking around with 100 pounds or 300 pounds on your back, you're walking around with an empty pack. And that can be you. You just got to get some help. I couldn't do it by myself. I got to tell you, man, it was a near thing. I barely made it. But I found people that were, you know, helpful to me, and I was able to do that, to take a rock out of my pack a little bit at a time.
Yeah, excellent. I'm glad you found those resources when you did. Sounds like your pack was really heavy. Bill, a final comment or question for Jim?
Well, just more a comment, but before I forget, Jim, thank you. It's great to have you here and to share with us. One of the things I often do when I introduce myself to a crowd of people before I talk is I tell them that I've not done it all and I've not seen it all, nor do I help to do it all and see it all. I'm actually very content in my career to have not done a lot of things. And I don't go out of my way to see or watch traumatic events or anything. It will happen, and I'll deal with it when it happens there in front of me, but I don't go out of my way to find it. So that's just my words of advice is, you know, slow down, smell the coffee, enjoy the flowers, and, you know, remember that you want to be in it for the long run. And to be in it for the long run, you have to find that true balance.
That's a great comment. Jim, do you have a thought you want to wrap us up on before we move into recommendations?
Sure, just a quick little ditty. I just have to be looking at the slide. These things predispose us to being traumatized and to getting thrown off. One of them is childhood traumas. If you've already been traumatized, the chances of you being affected by the things that you see in our business are pretty good. Life out of balance, we talked about. People that have ADD and ADHD, whatever you think about those things, research is pretty clear that if you have those issues, that you are more predisposed to being traumatized. Problems with alcohol and drugs, nobody has that in our business. Life stressors, if your life has added things, certainly your ability to be stressed is greater. And it turns out these three things have blew me away. Your personality, your genetics, and the structure, the physical structure of your brain, those three things can predispose you to being traumatized. And those things actually we have very little control over, obviously, but just something to think about.
Well, thanks for that. Before I forget, if listeners want to connect with you and find out more about the work and the instruction that you do, what's the best place for people to connect with you?
Couple ways. You can go to my website, which is www.allriskconsulting.com. You can mail me anytime, and that's jim@allriskconsulting.com. And feel free, you can call me, 720-252-4599. If I can help you, I'd be happy to.
Well, thanks. And, Jim, we'll put those in the show notes for listeners, and make sure you check out Jim's website and connect with them. Gentlemen, we like to wrap up our show with recommendations. Maybe it's something you read or an app you've been using or an event that you have planned or something that you want to share both tonight with other educators but also with other EMS leaders. And it's always wonderful for me to have this opportunity to talk to leaders in EMS education. I want to share two things. The first is especially relevant. Mike Rubin, who's the columnist for EMS World Magazine, the back page columnist, his August first column was titled "The Cry for Help." And he writes about this same topic that we've been discussing tonight from the vantage point of that he's increasingly seen in social media and online communities. People that he's interpreting a cry for help, and he's sharing what he's how he's reaching out to those people oftentimes that he doesn't actually know other than that they have a shared interest like him in being an EMT or paramedic. And I will put that link in the show notes. And then our friend Mike Ward, who's been on the podcast before, he's recently published at EMS1.com that topic we talked about early on and in lots and lots of episodes, the importance of a college degree. And he includes in this note to the young caregiver, going to university as an 18-year-old is the best investment of your time and interests. And he gives three reasons why. And this is a must-read for anyone that hasn't finished their degree yet, or if you spend time teaching or supervising or working with young people that haven't finished college degree yet. Give this a read and help guide them towards that that path. So those are my two recommendations. Bill, do you have something for us?
Sure, I do. But just to tag on to that is, you know, the opportunity to gain higher education is that it opens doors to you that may never have been opened before, but the advantage of continuing in higher education even after your initial undergraduate degree is that the more that you have, the longer those doors will stay open. And I really want to encourage people that there's a great deal to be learned by both the School of Hard Knocks, but then to gain that recognition for all your hard work is to formalize it and get that formal education. You know, so I do encourage people there. So my recommendation is, and I've only reviewed this. I shared this with Greg, with you and Rob, but it's a colleague of mine found it. It's called Mobile Intensive Care Units, Advanced Emergency Care Delivery Systems. And it was written in 1976. And the editors of this include, Dr. Nagel and Sapphire. And I think that it's really an early look at the beginnings of paramedics in the United States as well as other places in the world. And this group preceded what became what we know now as the pre-hospital care and disaster medicine folks. So it's just a very early look into, particularly if you have a historical interest, it's an early look into how EMS systems developed, truly in their infancies by really pioneering people at the time. It's a little pricey. You can find it on Amazon. It runs around $90.
Bill, do you have a copy of this book already?
Of course I do.
Excellent. Well, maybe you just, with that price point, listeners might be scrambling to that collection of old books in their school's paramedic classroom or something, saying, I got to get this up on eBay. But yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes with the title and the authors as well as that Amazon link. Chris, how about you? What's your recommendation or endorsement?
You know, one of the things that we talked about a little bit, and I guess even before we do that, I want to thank you, Greg, for the opportunity. And Bill, it's always great to have you and chat with you as well. Jim, you've given me writer's cramp tonight, so I want to thank you for that and sharing your story with us. But one of the things I said earlier on is I talked about, you know, leading with emotional intelligence. And I'm reading a book right now that's really kind of excellent. It's by Daniel Goleman, and it's called Primal Leadership, Learning to Lead with Emotional Intelligence. And it really kind of talks about how you deal with your own emotions and the emotions of the folks that are around you, but dealing with primal leadership or leading with primal leadership, and meaning that to touch the emotional spark of your employees. You know, it doesn't matter what your strategies are. It doesn't matter what your visions are. It doesn't matter where your budgets are. You know, to get things done in your organization, you hold the rudder and your employees are the wind in your sail. And we have to be able to lead with emotional intelligence. So go ahead and check that book out. I think you'd be really interested. And Greg, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and chat with you. I always had fun. I always have fun when I come here with you guys. And I learn a lot of stuff, and it just goes back to the fact of, you know, the core of who we are is educators, and that seems to never go away, huh?
Well, it's wonderful to, you know, this profession gives us the opportunity to be caregivers, teachers, and leaders, and that, I mean, I'm not sure what's left other than those three things, right? Those are the big three things in life. Jim, do you have a recommendation or endorsement, something that you want educators and EMS leaders around the world to know about?
Just a resource that I stumbled across a while back, and it has just a ridiculous amount of good information. It's www.ptsd.va.gov, and they have obviously a tremendous amount of experience with post-traumatic stress and the work they're doing now in therapy, and I think they need to increase that and take care of our people better. But be that as it may, that is just an excellent resource and someplace I go to find information all the time.
Well, thanks for that, and we'll include that in the show notes as well. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at this point in the show, if listeners, you've made it this far, if you're feeling alone or down or just that this career you're in is really weighing you down, this is a final word of encouragement from the four of us to ask for help. And we care about you. You have friends and family that care about you, and we need you to get healthy and get well. And there's resources out there that can help you on that path. And Jim has offered up his email and phone number. And, of course, if you want to start that communication by contacting me and I can help get you on that path, I'm happy to as well. So, gentlemen, thanks so much. This has been an important topic, and I'm really glad we had this discussion. And, Jim, we're so glad you're here to talk with us about it.
I just appreciate the opportunity and enjoyed it very much. You guys are great.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.